You know, the Irish economy is phenomenal. This country is motoring. It's doing a great job. And I think we can be an amazing country if we just maintain our optimism, but don't fall for risk aversion and don't fall for orthodoxy.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is David McRedmond, Chief Executive of An Post, a man who grew up in Dundrum in Dublin but gained priceless business experience in London with Waterstones and in the United States before returning to Ireland. He has worked for Aircom and TV3, and for the past 10 years he's headed our commercial state body An Post, overseeing big changes where parcel and financial services are the name of the game, with the price of a stamp also continuing to rise. It's now at €1.85 compared to just 72 cent in 2015. David McRedmond, you're welcome to the Insights podcast. We'll come back to the price of stamps and parcels a little later, but let's start with your background. You grew up, as I say, in Dublin. You're a city boy.
I'm a city boy. I grew up in Dundrum. I'd like to say I'm a suburb boy, you know, and I'm very proud to have grown up in Dundrum. Dundrum represents to me, you know, at the time, really, when Ireland was beginning, the 60s and 70s, Ireland was beginning to modernise, and it was a brave new world. It was a time when Belfield was built. It was a time when the suburbs were built, when big churches were actually built as well. And I loved growing up in Dundrum. It's a very democratic place, a very normal place to grow up.
And in your family, in your background and also in your own life and indeed in your family's life, there's a kind of a media streak running through it. Your father was a very well-known journalist.
He was. And he was the youngest editor, I think he said, of the Irish Independent. And he was a broadcast journalist as well. And he was known for really breaking stories around Vatican II and
Louis McRedmond, I should remind
Louis,
listeners.
Louis, and Louis, he was in his day, he was fairly progressive and revolutionary, and he certainly very much espoused that sense of Ireland could be a very forward-looking place if we wanted it to be, and it could be a great country, but we were held back by certain forces, the conservative forces that, and at that time, particularly in the late 60s and 70s, and even into the 80s, that constant battle between the conservative and liberal forces, he'd have been firmly in the liberal side. I perhaps would have seen it at the time as being he was very liberal and very, but actually, of course, he was conservative too. It was all just within the parameters of Ireland. But media is something which, yeah, was instilled in us, and I loved it, and I've always wanted to be a journalist. I might be a journalist someday. You never know. My daughter is a journalist. And
she's a columnist with the Irish Times, Finn McRedmond, and she does work in the UK as well.
Yes, she's a writer with New Statesman, and she's retained her column in the Irish Times because she was advised by a very great journalist there that's real estate, that's journalism real estate. You want to hold that. And so every Thursday I wake up and have to listen to my daughter lecturing me about something as I read her in the Irish Times. But I'm very proud of her. You know, and it's not just Finn I'm proud of. My son, Ben, who lives in New York, and he took the brave decision to go to the States. He said, I'm not going to university. I'm just going to go straight to America, and I'm going to follow my dream to be a tech founder. And he's been incredibly successful. And my daughter, Georgia decided to be a psychologist and is training to be a psychologist, having finished her master's in London in King's, and she's living there. So, you know, the variety you have is something extraordinary that I never imagined.
And for somebody who spent his professional life, or most of it anyway, in basically as a businessman, your academic background, I mean, you studied history, was it, and politics?
Yeah, that's right.
And your history, your master's thesis was far removed from business.
My master's thesis was on church building in Ireland in the first half of the 19th century, in Dublin. And it was very specifically about Catholic emancipation and how the church came from the back streets out onto the main streets, and the whole emergence of the idea of a of what then was a very democratic church, democratic institution. It was revolutionary in its time. You know, I loved the French Revolution. I loved studying that in my undergrad. But this was something which was a real eye opener, and actually gave me a real grow for Dublin. It gave me a sense as to what can happen. You know, we talk today about infrastructure and the challenges and all of those things. I mean, here was a church which was very central to the people, having to work out how do we cater for the people? What do we do? And with no money, and got the money from parishioners and built these huge churches throughout Dublin, like St Andrew's in Weston Row, or the Pro Cathedral, or St Audens, the new St Audens, and these churches. So I thought it was fascinating. It was more social and economic history in many ways.
And then at the relatively young age of 24, you found yourself in London. Why did you head off there?
I headed off there like many others. It was the middle of the 1980s, you say, and I had to try and find a job. And I thought that if I went to London, I could get a job maybe in the BBC as a journalist or an editor in the London Times. And that was the plan. And I went over, and after 6 weeks of getting absolutely nowhere and having ridiculous expectations, I ran out of money. I walked. I remember walking 3 miles to be interviewed by Tim Waterstone for one of the first Waterstone's bookstores. And I got a job in a bookstore thinking this would be a stopgap. But it actually ended up making my career for me.
How did you get on with him? Because you managed to develop a good relationship with him. I mean, he was the top man.
Yeah. He only had a couple of bookstores when I met him. And he was and is a wonderful, wonderful man. And it was quite interesting. His career was such that he had worked for W.H. Smith, and he'd been fired by them after trying to grow them in the United States. And he came back, and then he decided to set up Waterstones. He gave me many of the things that I think have certainly energized my life. He was very, he believed in being ambitious. He said, look, you know, there's no point doing things in a small way. Let's build a huge book chain, the biggest book chain in Europe. Let's open everywhere. Also a sense of mission. Let's bring great books to every town in Britain and Ireland and eventually into the United States. Let's do all of that. And I liked that. And I also liked, there was a kind of streak of anti-establishment to him. And probably not unlike my father, in that it was anti-establishment, but not really. It was a kind of establishment, anti-establishment. But he wanted to take on people like W.H. Smith. He wanted to take on the orthodoxy that, oh, you couldn't have full range bookstores. You wouldn't be able to sell poetry in Bradford, you know. He says, of course you can sell poetry in Bradford. If you have poetry in Bradford, you won't if you don't. And that was very much his mission, his style. Something else he really affected me about him was, this was a job for me as a bookseller on the shop floor. And the respect he gave me and the respect he gave everybody. He said, this is a really important job. This is a noble profession. It matters. He was very keen on just employing mainly graduates and people who weren't bookworms. He didn't like the phrase bookworm, didn't like that idea, but people who were generally interested in the world. He'd prefer if you read The New Yorker or Vanity Fair. And that was his idea. And it stuck with me ever since, that this sense that if you respect the shop floor, if you respect the front line, you get it back in spades.
How long did you stay with him then, and how far did you advance in the business?
So I stayed with him. I stayed with him and then stayed beyond him because he sold the business. I stayed with him and he asked me to open Waterstones in the United States. So I was started in 1986 and went to the United States in 1990 and with nothing, and just landed in Boston. I had just got married to Penny and we landed in Boston, and I had to find an apartment and then decide what I was going to do. And we opened a massive bookstore in Back Bay and in Boston, and it was a huge success. And then in the middle of that, he'd sold the company to W. H. Smith. So W. H. Smith then got their kind of claws on it and decided to corporatize the whole thing. And suddenly this wasn't a mission. This was to be a test. And I've always hated tests ever since. I hate the idea of piloting. But we opened another bookstore in Chicago, which was a disaster. I made terrible errors there. So I did well in Boston, badly in Chicago. But I was there a few years. And then I came back to the UK and was the operations director for Waterstones in the UK and Ireland for another few years until W. H. Smith yanked me out of there.
Fired you?
No. They sold W. They, having bought it, they sold it 4 years later. They'd made a massive return on it. They did really well when nothing else was working for W. H. Smith. No, they kept me. They said I couldn't go with it. They wanted me to run their railway station and airport stores. And I thought, this is really miserable. I was so sad. And I was living in Ealing, which is the kind of Dundrum of London. And I was driving down to Swindon to their head office. I thought, this is so miserable. And eventually my wife told me to get over myself. And I did. And we worked out that actually, you know what, these are coal mines. And I remember spending a day in W. H. Smith and Paddington Station and thinking, wow, so many people coming in and out. How interested are they? What are they doing? Everyone was reading because they were commuting. They're all commuting and train, and everyone was reading. And I thought, this is really interesting. We could turn this into something. And so I set up a separate company for W. H. Smith, separate supply chains, distinctive merchandising, and that was called W. H. Smith Travel Retail, which 10, 15 years later is what W. H. Smith became. In fact, they've just sold their high street business and kept the travel retail. So it's something I often say when I talk to graduates or talk to MBA programs, and they ask, what's career advice? I say, do the unpopular job. Nobody wanted to run the railway station stores. That's where there's gold. You know, if you do the unpopular thing, you can do fantastically. If you go into Google, guess what? You're just another person in Google, you know. So it was actually a miraculous couple of years for me because the business went from strength to strength, did fabulously. They then sent me to the United States to try and do the same again. It kind of worked and kind of didn't work.
You were in Atlanta, were you, for several years?
I was in Atlanta for a few years. I didn't warm to Atlanta. I found it at that stage, it was still quite a divided city. In some ways still is, you know, it's very divided racially. Found that quite difficult to deal with. A lot of the issues at work were around race. I also found it fairly boring, to be honest, because there wasn't a lot to do. Now, I wasn't a golfer or a tennis player or something, and that's what I needed to be to really love it and enjoy it. It's a fine city, and it's a fine city now, but even then it wasn't that big a city.
Was it always your and Penny's intention to come back to Ireland?
I don't know. I've rarely planned things or thought of things in that way. She made it very clear after we'd been there about a year and a half that we were coming back. The idea was to go back to London. And eventually she said, look, the children, and by that stage I had two children, my daughter Finn, my daughter Georgia hadn't yet arrived, but she said, we're going back to London and follow us when you get a job. And so I was in Atlanta on my own for about 6 months. But the job I got, and much to her surprise, was in Dublin. And so that caused an interesting conversation. And I had no idea what the company was. It was called Aircom. I had never heard of it.
And really?
I'd left in 1986. I knew of Telecom Éireann, but I'd never heard of Aircom. And they asked me to come back and run their, what they call their non-core businesses. So, and it was funny, things like telephone directories and golden pages and telephone boxes. And I've always had a real draw to the really unpopular, old-fashioned stuff, and then tried to turn it around and do something. So that's why I came back to Dublin.
Part one and part two of the phone book. Part one being the dummy.
Like, that's right.
Are absolute museum pieces.
They are museum pieces. And well, even then, when I came back, very quickly I realised the thing was a bit of a basket case. It had been floated, and everybody was losing their shirt on it, and it was taken private by private equity. And I was asked to sell all these businesses, and I sold, I remember selling Golden Pages to a Dutch company and sold it for a valuation of about 350 million. And it was an astonishing valuation. And nobody now knows what Golden Pages is or what a Yellow Pages telephone
They bought is. A turkey, did they?
Well, they bought at the top of the market. I'd never now undersell, but it was a fine company at the time. But unfortunately, the world moved on pretty fast.
And you yourself moved on after how many years there?
So I was there for 6 or 7 years, and it was a strange time because it was the absolute height of the Celtic Tiger, you know, 2000 to 2006. And I actually didn't really enjoy it. I found it very, there was a level of cynicism around, and there was a level of, you know, it felt more like trying to mimic a kind of Anglo-American capitalism. Let's make as much money as we can, as quickly as we can. And I think, and I'm not against that, and I made money out of it, and I'm grateful that I made money out of it. What I'm against is not having a mission or a purpose. And, you know, I was very, very keen. It was very clear to me, not because of me, but because of those around me, some really good people in Aircom who further down the organisation who all said, the future's broadband. It's got to be broadband. And indeed, I remember a big battle amongst the executives whether it was going to be broadband or mobile. And they backed mobile. And I'm going, it's going to be broadband. And very generously, a very brilliant man who was there, Herb Rebar, texted me about 20 years later when I became chairman of AIR and said, you were right, it was broadband. So it was a time, though, when we didn't really do anything other than make big returns for private equity owners.
Where was Tony O'Reilly in all of this?
Tony O'Reilly was the chair, and he was an extraordinary man. And if, you know, the moments of joy I did have there were working with him. He was larger than life. You'd go down to see him in Castle Martin, and it was the man in full, you know, it was the Tom Wolfe type character. And he had a great breath to him, very amusing to be with, very passionate. He had an extraordinarily a complex relationship with government and how should government be. And he taught me a lot around government. They asked me, after I'd sold those companies, I was going to leave, and he asked me to stay to run regulation. And I'm like, I'm not interested in regulation. And actually, and the chief executive at the time, he also, Phil Nolan, said, no, do regulation. It's interesting. I found it fascinating. And actually, I'll be one of the few people to turn around and say, regulation is amazing because it is that interface between private industry and society. And that's an interface I love being at. I love being at that point between something that's very public and yet something that can be run properly and commercially. So, but that was just battle after battle with regulators and high court cases and battles with government. And you never battled hard enough for Tony O'Reilly.
Are you a naturally pugnacious kind of person?
I used to think so. I'm less pugnacious than I used to be. No, I'm not so much pugnacious, but I'm an enthusiast, and certainly I'll get out there.
And you're not afraid of a scrap.
I'm not afraid of a scrap. And I think, you know, you've got to have, I think good businesses have courage, you know, they have strategic courage. Otherwise you're just coasting along. You have to have strategic courage and direction. And I really believe in that. If you have that, that's great. I'm not up for a fight just for a fight.
After Aircom, then you found yourself running TV3, as it was then.
Yes. So I left Aircom. It was taken over for about the fourth time, and this time by Australian private equity. And they made the other private equity companies look like the most responsible companies on the planet. This was really, they just felt that they could do a trick around the regulatory model. I knew it wasn't going to work, and I knew that the Irish government wouldn't allow certain things. And so I left, and I pretty quickly got approached by the new owners, again, private equity, of TV3. And I thought, fantastic, I'd love to do this. And this at last was my chance to fulfill my media dreams and get into media. And I went into TV3 and this was in 2006, and two wonderful years there, growing really fast. We had a great strategy, a fantastic young team, committed people, many of whom are in RT now. And then in probably May the 4th, 2008, the global financial crash hit. And we knew it first. We knew it first in TV3, because the canary in the gold mine is advertising, and advertising fell off a cliff in April. And then we thought, well, maybe this is just one odd month. And then May again. And I realised, this is real trouble. This is real trouble now. I remember that July in 2008, we used to, at that time, there used to be the social partnership, you'll recall, Sean, where the government and the unions and everybody would agree what the national increase would be in pay. And the partners met, and IBEC, you know, the employers, were recommending a 6% increase, which was to be moderate. And I'm going, are you kidding yourselves? I'm putting in place a pay freeze. And they said, no, 6%. And then by September, I was pushing in place 10 or 20% pay reductions. Really, really tough times. And the next 5 years were such a slog, just trying to keep the company afloat.
Now, you had a relationship, I think, and you were, would you call it a franchise or whatever? You had arrangements with ITV, and you managed to get some pretty strong programmes from them. Was Coronation Street among them?
Yeah, what happened was, well, it was already there when I got there, that the station was very much built around that ITV franchise, Coronation Street, Emmerdale, and some other programmes. We were very clear that we need to do more Irish programming. And I absolutely credit the investors, Doughty Anson. They said, look, we back you in this. And even in the middle of the financial crisis, they gave the money to build a studio out in Ballymount. I always love telling the story that the studio, when it was built, and it was a high definition studio and the best in the country and probably still is. But I said, is this now the biggest in the country? And they said, well, it's about the same size as the, it's the exact same size actually as the Studio One in RTE. I said, well, can you make it a metre bigger? I want to have the biggest studio. So that was my Trumpian moment. So we built this studio, and we did a lot of studio programming from there. Brought in Vincent Brown, who was hugely important to the station. And so gradually the mix was developing. But just as we were coming out of the financial crash and we'd renegotiated our loans, we'd done everything, started growing again, I was driving into work, and it was on the RT News that UTV were going to launch in the Republic of Ireland. And there was an interview with the then managing director saying, yes, and we've taken all the programmes off TV3. And they'd done a deal behind our back with ITV, which they're entitled to do, but ITV weren't really, but they did that deal. And they said, we're going to open in 18 months' time when the contract is up in TV3, and we're going to finish them off. And I remember going into TV3, going into our newsroom, huge newsroom, and I got everybody together for a town hall, and there were people in tears and saying, it's the end. And I'm going, no, we'll get through this. We'll have no problem. We'll get through it. And I remember going upstairs, head in the hands, going, what are we going to do? But as determined we would. And I had a very good CFO who said, you know what? I think we'll get through it. And I said, well, look, the key was you had to stay number two in the market, RT be number one in terms of ratings. If you're number three in advertising terms, you're finished. So we looked at our ratings, and we started our own soap, Red Rock, because we were going to lose Coronation Street.
A very good soap it was too.
Really good soap. And I really regretted that it wasn't kept up after I left. But and we did a lot more daytime programme, did a lot of things. It came to the day that UTV opened, and they'd been shouting in the press that they were going to win, that they were the best, that they were real professionals and all of that. They did it so much that it actually really browned off people in the Republic, who just said, actually, you know what, we quite like TV3. And they didn't like it before, but they weren't going to allow this to happen. So when UTV opened, I remember we had a share of the market of about 14%, dropped pretty quickly to about 8%. They opened at about 6% and going, oh, Lord. And over the next 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, they gradually increased 6.5, 7%. We went 8.5, 8.4, 8, 7.5. They were at 6.5. And the CFO kept saying, they won't get there. They've underestimated the value of daytime programming, Vincent Brown, Late at Night, and Ireland AM. And sure enough, it was as if the waters parted again. It stopped. And we started growing our share again. And they were finished. They were finished within 8 weeks. They were finished. And it was very sad for UTV because it was the end of the last PLC in Northern Ireland. And I was very proud of it. And I don't like putting anybody out of business. I was proud we'd done it. I immediately said to our shareholders, OK, now we need to sell, because there was no way. I knew we couldn't be standalone. We sold to Virgin, and that took a while. That took about a year. And as soon as Virgin bought us, they picked up UTV for a song. But we sold for a reasonable price, and the investors got some of their money back.
Twice you've mentioned Vincent Brown, a mutual friend, I think it's fair to say. And the word pugnacious might just apply to that individual.
Vincent was, he was the most extraordinary force as a broadcaster. And his, I mean, I think of a couple of things. I think of him deciding and coming to me with the kind of mad idea. He said, you know, there's an election coming up. We're going to do a debate in every single constituency. I said, are you nuts? You have a team of four people. He says, nope, we'll do it. That's, I'm determined to do it. We'll go in. He went around every constituency. There'd be 1,000 people in a hall in Carrickmacross, and we'd have to broadcast from there. It was a marathon. It was actually one of the most extraordinary feats. But there were a couple of others. I mean, a stroke of genius was when we were blocked at the time of the marriage referendum. We were blocked from Dublin Castle. And they said, no, RTE have it, and you can take their feed if you want. I'm going, no, we want to do our own program. Vincent said, I want to do my own program. And I said, no, you can't get in there. He says, well, and they came back, and I'd like to take credit for it. I didn't have the idea, but they came back. They said, we'll do it from the George, the then famous gay pub in Dublin, which backs on virtually to Dublin Castle. So we did it from there. And we did this extraordinary 5-hour broadcast. And I remember having to do an interview myself because they'd run out of anybody to interview. I mean, we were all piled in there. But that was brilliant, brilliant journalism and a commitment to it. I remember him breaking into somebody's house in Killiney. Do you remember a house was being repossessed or something? He wanted to see what it was looking like. So yeah, I think he was. And there was something else about it. And this was certainly where I was keen. I remember when he started, it was bouncing around the schedule. You know, might start at 10:30 or 10:50 or 11. I said, no, has to be a fixed time. Has to be 11 o'clock every night. And this was, you know, brought me back to my days living in the States, you know, the late night broadcasting programs. And, you know, they were, they'd be in your diary, in your head, 11 o'clock, you watch it. And he just won that slot, 11 to 12. And it was phenomenal. And so that, I think, was something which gave TV3 a credibility which it hadn't had. I should say also, very fond of Ireland AM and what that team achieved. People like Mark Cagney and that whole team were quite, you know, and the professionalism was underestimated. I think underestimated by RTE. And RTE once or twice would try to dip their toe in the water at breakfast television and realise, actually, you know what, that thing that looks very simple is actually quite complicated to produce. To get the people along, to get the sort of presenters. And
they had a later starting time, which I think was due to rostering arrangements. That never helps, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you somebody who gets a kind of a 7-year itch after a certain period in a job?
It sounds like it. I think so, yeah. And in the funny thing is I sold the company and then left. They didn't want me, I think they quite rightly. And I spent about 6 months doing bits and pieces of work in London and between here and London. Absolutely loved it. And back to my more sort of private equity work. And then the job came up and on Puss, and I got a call around. I thought, do I really? I'd never worked in the public sector. And I had thoughts previously around RT and that, but I thought, you know, it's a really big brand and it's a big company. Let's take a look.
Is it true, and we'll come back to RT later, that at one stage you applied for the position of Director General? I'm not talking about recently, but you didn't actually get even called for interview.
No, I didn't get called for interview. Yeah, that's true.
How did that go down with you?
You know, it's. I always say to people, you know, around jobs and they're looking for jobs, apply for hundreds of jobs. I go back to my time when I arrived in London and thought I'd be a journalist in BBC. You know, there are vagaries around jobs and how you get them.
And maybe somebody else's name was on it. But anyway, you ended up in On Post.
Yeah. So I ended up in On Post. And On Post, just an extraordinary company. I mean, I was in there in the first day and I couldn't make head or tail of it. And I realised also that not only did I have no money, we still have no money. We never have any money in On Post, but we generate a lot of money. So we manage that. It was a company that operationally was strong, had a good network, all of that, but had no future because it was just declining revenues because it wasn't in the commercial parcel business. And I realised, in fact, it was the unions who said to me, you've got to be in the commercial parcel business. We're going to have a future. And they were quite insistent on it. And I said, OK, let me take a look. But I said, I've got to do something in the meantime because we have no money. And so I went to government and said, I think we need to put her into examinership because you know, we've got creditors. And they go, you can't, we own it. I'm going, I've got 10,000 employees as creditors, or at that time, 12,000. And I've got other creditors. And they're going, well, what can we do? And I said, they said, can you cut costs? And I go, and I can, but you have to pay money to do that. And that takes a long time. And they said, anything else? I said, yeah, remove the price cap on the stamp. And the stamp was at 72 cent. So they removed, I persuaded them they had to do that. They did not like it, but they removed the price cap and took legislation. And they said, what will you put it up to? And I remember the board at the time saying, yeah, it should be at 85 cent. And I said, ridiculous, put it up to 95 cent. And that's a big increase. And I said to governments, we'll do, but the price cap had now gone. And just before we put it in, I got focus groups together. I said, I wonder what would happen if we put it up to a euro. So we had two focus groups, and one focus group, putting it up to a euro, said it'd be a disgrace, be awful, be the end of the postal service, we hate it. I said, OK. I said, and what did the 95 cent group say? And they said, oh, it's awful, the end of the postal service, we hate it. And I said, OK, well, you may as well put it up to a euro. The difference between 95 cent and a euro was 20 million. And we made 20 million profit the next year. And it's, I think it is.
God, if you could only have got the job in RT and done the same thing with the licence fee. I mean, people would now be paying 300 euro a year minimum, and RT would have had no problems.
And
said maybe, he superficially.
Yeah, and be the best broadcaster in Europe. You know, I think we do, joking apart, we do have to really sometimes think about what we want. And all my career, and this goes right back to Tim Waterstone, you know, you're fighting against orthodoxy. And the orthodoxy that you should cut costs, just cut costs, just get small, just cut costs, just don't be a burden. And you're kind of thinking, what is that about? You know, the reason why these companies exist, RTE, On Post, ESB, DAA, the semi-states, they exist to provide public service.
Yeah, but relentlessly, though, I mean, it didn't stop at a euro. It's now up, what, a 185?
Yeah.
And then internationally, it's the UK and Europe, 350. Worldwide, 395. I mean, all from a base, okay, of 72 to 185.
Sure, and the reason, and you know, this is the choice, is do you want to have a really good world-class postal infrastructure? And the infrastructure, the word postal makes people think of a couple of letters being delivered on the Iron Islands. It's not that. It is about e-commerce, logistics and trade. Do we want a world-class trade company? Yes, I think we do. And I think it's really important for people. And people saw that during COVID. We were the only postal service in Europe to keep every postal route open, to keep every post office open, to provide a really serious public service, to have a social purpose, to do things that really matter to people. Yes, the price matters, but we know that the price of a stamp is immaterial to most people.
Yes, but the use of the postal system, posting letters, is decreasing. It went down 7% last year, 7% the year before. I think it's halved over the period of your
leadership. But that's nothing.
That's not
to do with the price of a stamp. That's to do with email and
yeah. But how long can you sustain? How long can you sustain a postal service if people aren't using it, or at least if they're not paying enough to keep it going, unless you're putting the price of the stamps way beyond their means?
So, well, it's not beyond anybody's means. You know, people post 3 or 4 letters a year. You know, an extra euro is not beyond anybody's means.
But people stop sending Christmas cards, for instance.
Yeah, I think there you have to be careful at certain times in Christmas cards, make sure you have good discounts, make sure that, you know, when people have to send a lot or when there's bulk, and we'll do that. And look, we want to introduce more varied services in terms of letters. So there can be a cheaper service, there can be a 3-day service, but that requires changes in regulations and all of that.
As of now, it's got to be next day or a daily availability, yeah?
It's got to be next day. And we'll always have a next day service as long as I'm there. Mind you, I'm not there that much longer, but I would imagine Unpost will always have a next day service. But we've, you know, that will probably just, you know, do you know what people use next? What they want next day for is birthday cards, is condolences cards. That's what it's used for by people. 85% of mail is business, is businesses sending stuff. And that's a 3-day. And that at the moment is on 3 days. So it's not that big a change. Ultimately, Unpost is becoming it was a letters company. It's now a letters and parcels company. And it's becoming an e-commerce and logistics company.
What I'm wondering is there a parallel between, say, or a similarity between the print media moving over to e-versions?
Absolutely.
And the question is asked, how long will we be able to buy a printed edition
Absolutely.
Of the Irish Independent or whatever it
Look,
is?
Look, all companies...
So how long more will the postal... How long more will we be able to post letters?
You'll be able to post letters for as long as you want to post them. Because we're
not going to go the route of Denmark, for instance.
We'll always have. No, I don't think so. We'll always have. Now, how long will people want to post letters? Will there be letters in 20 years' time? I think possibly not. Will they be there in 10 years' time? I think so. I think there's certain arguments. There's a whole load of arguments for maintaining letters, and there's a great use to letters, and particularly, you know, in these times of digital, cyber attack, information attacks, all of those things. Actually, people are seeing a real value to it. But we will always be able to do it because our network is becoming a parcels network. It's just you deliver it different over a parcels
network. How long will the local post office last, though?
Well, the local post office, for the first time in years, is increasing the number of transactions last year. Increased number of transactions. Why? Because of Vinted. Vinted is marketplace parcels. Now 15% of the parcels market, which is where people buy and sell through website. And that's how big it is. And people drop off at a post office. So every business I've been in, whether it's been telecoms, when I was in Aircom, when I joined it, 95% of its revenue, probably a bit less, 90% of its revenue was voice calls on a fixed line call. That's now 0.01% of its revenue. It all became something different. Broadcasting, you know, Netflix, all of those. What is broadcasting becoming? It's becoming, as RTE are doing, and I think Kevin Backer is making the right choice, it's becoming a publisher broadcaster, where it's actually about making programmes and commissioning programmes rather than just focusing on linear broadcasting. Newspapers, you're absolutely right, they're moving to digital. And people rush to the end and say, oh yeah, you know, so at the moment in Unpost, you know, the majority of our revenue is from letters. So they're saying, oh yeah, but you won't be able to replace that 350 million of revenue. I'm going, well, I can't say now how quickly we'll replace it, but we will. And it amazes me, and again, this is the orthodoxy. Each year, government think we're going to collapse. Each year, there was a leak this summer about Ompus saying, well, it didn't really do well last year, although we did well. Yeah, its results say it made 50 million, but it didn't really.
Because there
really
was some point about your reserves having fallen below €1 million.
Well,
euro
there was
or something.
That, but there was also, I'll come on to that, but it was saying that because of two big elections, a general election, European election, that they made 70 million from that. So really, it would have lost 70 million if it wasn't for those elections. Well, we didn't have those elections this year. I've seen the first draft of our results and we've done better than we did last year. And they just simply cannot believe it. But this is what business is. And I remember around the elections, I said, yeah, we mightn't have elections, but we'll do something else. And it's a misunderstanding about business. Business is deterministic. It's not a forecast. Business is not,
What would you have done?
Michael O'Leary doesn't forecast and say, yeah, I think these people will be flying 10 years from now. No, he says, I'm going to open routes and I'm going to make them fly. And that's how we're going to grow. And I'm going to give them
reasons. Yeah, but what could you have done or what would you have done to acquire that 70 million from a means other than the elections?
Well, we've done it this year.
How?
Because this year we haven't had the elections. We've done it by growing our parcels by 30%. The biggest industry in the world is retailing. It's worth $21 trillion. Only 20% of it is online. It's going to keep going online. Retailing, bricks and mortar retailing is really going to be much, much, much smaller because it depends on intensity and that's going to go. So all of that is coming our way. We're at capacity. Each week in Christmas, we delivered over 3 million parcels. 3 million parcels a week. Our capacity is about 2.8. So, we're really at the point of almost overtrading.
Did the delivery of Christmas cards suffer? Was it deprioritised over the Christmas
combine? No, absolutely.
Because a lot of people are saying they got late cards from places they would never have got them before.
I saw that and I'm upset about that. But absolutely wasn't deprioritised, no. And we've actually had a good Christmas in terms of Christmas cards.
Would you accept that there was a later delivery in many cases of cards?
There was actually an earlier cut-off date and we did put that in place because we knew that the volume that was coming through of parcels was huge. So it was an early cut-off. We received 2 million Christmas cards post the cut-off.
My first cousin in Brooklyn in New York posted, and I saw the postmark on the 8th of December, and the card landed through my letterbox, I think, on about the 14th of January.
Well, I mean, you'll have to talk to your...
Now, that's 5 weeks. Why should it take 5 weeks?
Well, USPS, I'd ask them that question, the United States Postal Service, why it took... And I'm not kidding you. It took a long time. We post-Christmas, received huge containers of cards from outside Ireland. Now, I will be clear, there were some inside Ireland that were delivered late, but by and large, most cards were delivered on time.
What other business can Ompus work up? I mean, for instance, you've got this relationship now with financial institutions.
Yeah.
People can do transactions with their banks in local post offices. There was talk of maybe Ompus providing a mortgage service.
Yeah.
Where's that?
Well, just as in our delivery network, we're replacing letters with parcels, e-commerce, trade, and it's huge and it's gigantic. I'll get on to the financial services, but e-commerce, government has to understand, this is a tectonic shift. It's a tectonic shift like housing. It's a tectonic shift like migration. It's one of the big changes in the world. And we need to have the infrastructure for it and build that out. And that is going to grow and grow and grow. And it has a really positive benefit because people can live anywhere because they can get goods anywhere. Believe it or not, it's quite sustainable and probably isn't in terms of, I can't talk about what people are buying, but in terms of delivery from a network is cheaper, is more sustainable than people driving to get stuff. So there's a whole lot of good reasons for it. And that is huge and will keep growing. The other side of our business, the post office network, you know, you've declining social welfare, partly because some of it's going on to electronic transfer direct into accounts, but also because there's fewer people in social welfare. We're replacing that with financial services. And it's, again, really important. We have a network of 800 plus post offices. That is bigger than all of the banks put together. It's bigger, you know, it's by far the biggest network in the country. We now provide banking services throughout the country. That is a fantastic service. And in addition to doing the services for Bank of Ireland, for AIB, and hopefully soon for the other banks, we also are, we have our own Unpus Money services. And they're doing really well. Credit cards, current account. They're small and need to grow faster, but they're really good products. People like them. It's working. We keep winning awards for having, for example, the best credit card, etc. Mortgages is really tricky to get into. And we've always said we won't do it until we can find something that really works according to our purpose, which is, you know, we're very democratic, we're very fair, and we want something that's a cheaper mortgage in the market. And we are scouring the market and the possibilities for that. I know we've been doing that for a number of years, but we will find it and we will do it.
For instance, I mean, would there be an obvious partnership there between yourselves and the credit unions? Or is that
it's potentially the credit unions is more difficult because credit unions have their own capital through the credit union and all of that. And also, you know, we talk about the credit unions as if it's unified, as if it's a single company, which it isn't. So, and I've great respect for the credit unions. They do an amazing job and they're really popular.
And they're on the ground in local areas.
They're on the ground in local areas and huge respect there. So I think it's unlikely to be that, or more with major financial institutions where we can get the backing. And I think that's what we'd like to do. But we're growing the financial services. We've got to do more in partnership, you know, and I've said our strategy now is more in partnership, far more digitally, you know. We've become a digicore and the digicore is defined as over 30% of the revenues being digitally generated. We're up at nearly 40% of the revenues going through Unpus are generated digitally, mainly because people are ordering online or using financial services online. So, you know, technology is what's going to drive our future.
You've been emphasising how Unpus has gained and is generating business from the way retail is moving online. And there's great possibilities there with parcels as people buy stuff online and so forth and have it delivered by you primarily as well as others. But I'm wondering, is there not so much a contradiction, but is that something that's working against another one of the strands to your work? And that is it was done, I think, as a voluntary thing, chairing the Dublin City Task Force. It's got to do with trying to revive the Dublin City Centre. But, you know, if retail is moving the way you say it is, that really runs counter. And I'm not saying you want this to happen, but it's just a fact of life you have to deal with.
Yeah, I have to deal.
That people have less and less reason to go into the city centre.
You know, it is absolutely fundamental to everything I've done is a famous quote, I think it was Jack Welch, if the world outside your company is changing fast in the world inside your company, you're becoming irrelevant. But that's true of cities as well. If the world outside the city is changing fast in the world inside, you're becoming irrelevant. There won't be 20 shopping streets in Dublin. There won't be 10 shopping streets. There might be two, you know. Inevitably, retailing changes. But, you know, I've just come back. I was lucky enough to go on a trip to Bayonne last weekend for the rugby. And you see a town that is just full of brilliant, small, independent retailers. And you just think, wow, this is something different. This is great. And a town with fantastic cafes and bars and market, you know, and in the city centre. And now it's a small town. But there's no reason why Dublin can't be like that. It will always have retailing, you know, it will have shopping in the centre. But people come into Dublin more for entertainment now. Entertainment is really important. People will come into the city centre if there are things to do and things to see. We need more attractions. You know, we need, I think we need a really major, major museum, for example, like the African American Museum in the mall in Washington that brings millions of people in. You know, you need something like that. You need that mix. You need the mix, you know, the famous thing in Paris, what they call the 15-minute city, that everything's available in 15 minutes walk. But really what we need is more people living in the city centre. Only one person lives in O'Connell Street. Now, we ought to have thousands of people living on O'Connell Street. And that's what will change a city centre. Now, there's plenty of, since the task force report was delivered a year ago, and it's gone through the political system, the special purpose vehicle is about to be set up, and I cannot wait for that to happen and to really push on. Because what we're seeing is an awful lot of the initiatives are being delivered. They're being, you know, the task force report wasn't 10 recommendations for Dublin. It was 10 big moves that the agencies, whether it's the guards or the council or whoever, have committed to, and they're delivering. Dublin City Council are doing an amazing job. But in a very typical way at the moment, I think in Ireland, the whole is less than the sum of the parts. So there's 10 or 15 different good projects. What you need is something that pulls all of that together, that sense of mission, that sense of purpose. And for me, that's about turning Dublin One into one of the most happening neighbourhoods in Europe.
But it's even just walking through it on the way to Croke Park in recent times for the club finals. I mean, it's drab. It's run down.
Yes.
Tatty in many respects. Yes. So, I mean, you say they're the 10 big moves, but when will people see the kind of development and flowering that you're talking about?
I think within 18 months, you know, within 18 months, 2 years. I think, for example, the litter plan, which Dublin City Council are delivering and putting in compactors, getting rid of bagged waste, that will largely deal with the big problems we have with litter. And, you know, something like that can have a dramatic effect. There's far more guards in the street. I was in O'Connell Street myself last week and it was very noticeable. And it's credit, you know, they're out recruiting for the guards. Now, I think it's a real question mark. And I think as a society, we have to ask ourselves, what the hell did we do to allow the guard numbers drop so much? What did we do to allow our armed forces numbers drop so much? What did we do to allow there be no caretakers in flats? Last week, I visited the Ivy Trust. The Ivy Trust invited me to go and visit Kevin Street flats. Kevin Street flats, one of the most dense flat complexes in Europe, they say. So 1,500 people in this very small area. And you go into it. There is no antisocial behaviour. It's really well maintained. Beautiful landscaping, which the residents have done. And so I asked them, what's the difference here? There's a manager for the flats who's been there for 35 years. I met a caretaker who's been there for 40 years. There's two other caretakers as well. And that, you know, that's what we've lost in Ireland, that orthodoxy about cut your costs and do it. And people expect there isn't a consequence.
Something that might help deal with this situation and something you touched on earlier, one of the proposals, convert derelict sites into high density residential with provision for essential workers. Again, how quickly can we see that? Because
you're starting to see the conversion. So Dublin City Council, now it's a pilot scheme, but it's a pilot scheme because of planning, because otherwise it will take years. But they're doing North Frederick Street and Middle Abbey Street and looking at the dereliction. Now, that will be less high density residential. It's more above shops, but that will also be set aside, a big part of that will be set aside for essential workers. Pascal Taggart, the businessman, has been pushing for a long time for essential work programmes. Private sector is doing some. Google set up spaces for essential workers in apartments that they've been developing. There's on Middle Abbey Street, there's also student accommodation going in at Independent House, where my father was the editor. That is now being converted into student hostel, and that is fantastic. So all of these things, and this is what I mean, Sean, by saying, you know, there's a lot going on, but we need to make the whole greater. And to do that, it needs leadership, it needs purpose, it needs marketing. We need to bring people from Greater Dublin into the centre of Dublin.
One of the big things you presided over and initiated and led was the exit from the General Post Office of On Post as its headquarters. Now, there are still some people there, I think about 200, working for you, but the main bulk of your operation is down in the Dockland area. What would you do with the GPO?
I've been very open saying I think it should be a world-class museum of the Irish nation. You know, we've a very good small museum, really good, in the basement. Everybody should go and see it in 1916, called Witness History. But if we could have a museum, I mentioned the African American Museum in DC. You also have something like the Jewish Museum in Berlin. You have Yad Vashem in near Jerusalem. You have these extraordinary world-class museums, or indeed the Imperial War Museum in Britain, you know, that bring millions and millions of people. And that's something that I think could be fantastic in the middle of O'Connell Street, but also a way for us to make sure that we retain our history and tell our history and don't allow bad actors to take over our history. Tell our history in a proper way. Really make it one of the most exciting venues in not just Ireland, but in the world for Irish people to come to. We've a huge diaspora. You know, I saw it when there was a congressional delegation visiting the GPO, and you see people like Richie Neal in tears because they can't believe they're in the GPO. It's that emotive. It's that brilliant. That's why. Now, it could be something else. It could be RTE. It could be an RTE. It could be where RTE Radio is based. I think it would be fantastic for that, where RTE Radio originally came from. You could have an RTE News studio there. You could have any one of a number of things. People talked about putting the Abbey there. But we need to get moving with it.
And that brings me to the point raised by, I think it was John Collison of Stripe, one of the two brother billionaires, talking about how we used to be able to do things, but now because of maybe the need to get away from a sense of distrust of politicians, we've got so many layers now of bureaucracy, of oversight, that things just aren't happening the way they should. Is that a view that you identify with?
Completely. I completely identify with it. We went through a very difficult time, the global financial crash. I credit the civil servants for what they did in that. I credit difficult decisions of government. But we've got to get out of it. That's over a decade now, since that ended. And the risk aversion that came in then is something that has held us back, is holding us back dreadfully. Risk aversion, slow decision making, sclerotic decision making. We need an absolute sea change. We need to find ways to get decisions made 10 times faster. We have to calibrate so they're made faster. We have to have standards of administration. So that if I make a request of government as On Post, that I'm going to get an answer, yes, no, or otherwise, within, say, a month.
You know, are you in a position as chief executive of On Post to lift the phone and call the Taoiseach or your line minister directly without having to work through layers of civil servants?
Yes.
But would you do that, or have you done that?
I would do it very occasionally. I might once a year, you know, or if there was something really urgent or something really dramatic, I have done it. More often they've done it to me and I've had to take the call. That can happen still. And it does happen. And in many ways, you know, the politicians can only do so much. It's really at the civil service level now we need to really get active to get the country.
Many years ago, you mentioned about RT perhaps returning radio to the GPO. There was the false start where you applied and get interviewed. And then more recently, I think you were being headhunted, but then somebody leaked the fact and it didn't go anywhere. What would you have done had you become Director General of RTE?
I'd probably have done a lot of what Kevin Backhurst, who is the Director General, who I think, by the way, I actually think is a better choice than me. He had great experience in terms of BBC, in terms of RT News, in terms of Ofcom, and I think has done a pretty good job. I might have done it differently. I certainly would like to think that I don't think Donnybrook does a lot for RTE, although I have a great draw for this place since my father worked here, and I've also a real respect for the extraordinary buildings. The Scott Allen Walker campus is amazing. But times change. TV studios are on the edge of town. Radio studios are in the centres of towns. You change the culture. And I think that is happening. And Kevin's style is probably more understated and more suited than mine. But in the end, we'll probably end up at the same point. RTE becomes a commissioner of programming. I think RTE should also be the centre of independent production. And really, you know, we're an island that is still subscale. And that's the fundamental problem. It costs the same to make a programme in Ireland as it does in the UK. But BBC has an addressable audience 15 times the amount. So that ultimately is the economic problem. So we either have to make programmes to export, and that's beginning to happen very well in the industry here. And RTE can be a big part of that. And or we have to find a much more efficient way of doing things. I'm not sure TV3 or Virgin Media and RTE, I think, should share studios. There's no reason why we shouldn't have one production facility in Ireland for television. I think that could be an interesting approach. So I think there are ways it can move forward. But you do need to change. And it's back to a line I used earlier. The world outside is changing very fast. We need to change faster. But I tell you what does not help. Carping at RTE, constant slagging of RTE, making dramas out of things. There was very recently a big fuss, oh, three people have a pension who shouldn't have a pension or they were paid too much. I'm sorry. That is standard in every business. You know, you get errors. Only RTE gets pulled apart over it, or semi-states get pulled apart.
But no politician ever lost votes by having a go at RTE.
No, but that's good. But they've got to get over that.
Time is catching up with this, and you've got, I think, probably less than six yeah. months left with On Post. What are you planning for the future, or do you know what you're going to do?
I think I do. I think I've lined up a future. Look, I'm not going to work. I'll probably work full time, but I'm not going to do a single full time job. So I'll be doing non-executive work. I'm going on to a couple of boards. Boards where I think I can add real value, I hope. I've learned a bit about leadership, and I think hopefully I can use that. I want to do those things, but I also want to do some public work. And I'm very much very, very committed to the Dublin Task Force and what happens to that. And so I'm available to government and that, and they know that, and to the City Council. And so I see myself doing a mixture of that and probably then private sector work. So that would be the public work. And then private sector work, I'm really, you know, the Irish economy is phenomenal. This country is motoring. It's doing a great job. And I think we can be an amazing country if we just maintain our optimism, but don't fall for risk aversion and don't fall for orthodoxy.
In the meantime, though, you've got to consider your own personal well-being. I mean, you've had, I think, one or two brushes. You've spoken publicly about this with mortality, intimations of mortality you've come through them.
Yeah, I've come through them. Thank God. I've like many people, I've had a cancer and had operations and things like that. But, you know, I'm through that now. And I thank people in On Post, in particular my team, for being very patient around it. They probably quite enjoyed having the place themselves, but they did a fantastic job. So yeah, I've been very lucky, and I'm in good health now, thankfully. So I will push on and make sure that I'm really energetic and I can apply that energy.
And there's a fair bit left in the tank by the sound of things.
There is. You know, life is short. My sister Anne, who I was very close to and actually worked in RTE, passed away.
Worked with her on Primetime or Today Tonight, it might have been back in the day.
Yeah, that would have been it. And fantastic woman. And you just think life is short. And she said to me, you know, life is short. Enjoy every moment. Take every moment. And so I very much believe that.
David McRedmond, wishing you the very best in wherever life takes you and your career. Thank you indeed for joining me on the Insights podcast.
Thank you.
And you can find more Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke on RT Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening.